Views on this program are opinions of dental industry experts and not necessarily those of dentist advisors. Opinions shared in the following interview do not constitute personal financial advice. This program is furnished by Dentist Advisors, a registered investment advisor.
This is Dentist Money. Now, here's your host, Reese Harper.
Welcome to the Dentist Money Show, where we help dentists make smart financial decisions. I'm your host, Reese Harper, on site at Yankee Dental Congress 2017 with a special request guest, the national sales manager of Bank of America. We've been trying to get him on for a while, Mr. Bill Murray. Now, you might think this is the Bill Murray, and if you do think that it is, you're right. It's Bill Murray, the Bill Murray, not the actor.
I like to think of myself not as the actor. The Bill Murray. If you're talking dental financing, yeah. I am the Bill Murray.
Yeah. Well, and I was going to say, is it not the actor? We're talking about the legit Bill Murray, the national sales manager of Bank of America, Bill Murray.
That's correct. Okay?
Not this actor that was at the World Series.
Weird
singing.
Cubs fan.
Yeah. Okay. Not that guy.
No, I'm much better looking.
So today I'm really excited because we're going to talk about a lot of things that you've seen over your career, which has been, you know, you've had a lot of time in dental financing. You've seen things from real estate to financing to transitions to bad investments gone wrong to weird things happening within a practice. And I'll probably bounce around quite a bit because you've got a breadth of experience. But how about you tell us
a little
bit?
That was the nicest way anyone has ever called me old.
Okay.
I appreciate that.
Well, I mean, you still look young. I mean, all right. So let's talk a little bit about your background and the journey of getting to this point and, you know, the places you've been and kind of what you've seen. Let's just give everybody a little bit of background before we dive into more questions.
That's great. So this is actually my 20th year with Bank of America. Started my career in finance and credit, and in 2004 made the leap over to dental practice financing.
So was your role prior to sales more as an analyst? Were you doing, what were you doing?
Yeah, so I had a credit background.
Okay.
Yeah, so I did some financial due diligence.
You crunched some numbers.
Yeah, I was a number cruncher.
Cool.
Unbelievably.
Yeah.
And then in 2004, I said, I can't take numbers anymore.
Anymore.
I need to be in sales.
That's pretty rare. I mean, to see someone bridge the gap from quantitative to client facing, usually they stay in one camp or the other.
Yeah, I decided not to be a nerd anymore.
Well,
that helped.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have pegged you as that. That's awesome. You could probably add some things and subtract some things and make it all happen. Okay, so let's start off with kind of the current interest rate environment. What's going on with lending? There was a pretty big move in rates recently.
Sure.
It's kind of caused a ripple effect in the industry. I've heard people tell me, like, I can't get the same financing I thought I was going to be able to get. My interest rates are way higher. I'm never going to be able to retire. So what do you see the interest rate environment like? And it's hard to forecast that kind of stuff, but what's the current conditions of the market? How much have rates moved? And, you know, what are things looking like over the next few years?
I appreciate that. And I'll tell you, we've been spoiled for a very long time. I think since 2008, you know, rates being as low as they have. I mean, I can tell you that in 2004, when I started practice financing, our rates were 9 to 11%.
Yeah.
And that was a good rate at that point.
Interesting.
So we've been in the sub 4 to 4.5% range for the last probably 2 years. The best thing I could say is for a data point is look at the 10-year Treasury bill. We move our rates along with the 10-year Treasury.
Okay.
That's probably the biggest indicator we have for where rates are and where rates are going. As the economy gets better and as things loosen up, I think, from a regulatory perspective, you're going to see rates creep up. But again, when I hear people complain about 5%, you know, that's a pretty good interest rate right now.
Totally. It's still
right.
And it's the cost of capital is still very low. You
that's
can
exactly
grow your
right.
business a lot faster than that. There's no reason to
That's exactly right. It's not I don't look at it as a deterrent.
Yeah. Well, I mean, right now I don't know if this is too technical, but is there a spread above the 10-year Treasury? So if I say we're at 2.5 today, and so if 10-year Treasury is at 2.5 and rates are at 5, let's say on a practice loan and a 10-year loan, is that fair?
Yep.
Is that generally kind of a good benchmark for people to say, like follow the 10-year Treasury, and if I'm 2.5% higher than that,
that
might be where a practice loan
I would
might
say
be?
Anywhere from 2.5 to 3.5.
Okay.
You know, and it depends on the type of transaction you're looking at. It depends on what type of financing you're getting.
Credit.
Certainly, yes.
Yeah.
Certainly that
debt
all comes
to income.
Into, yeah.
So the quality, the risk ratios of the buyer is going to affect it, but 2.5 to 3.5% above the 10-year Treasury.
That's where we live.
And if you guys don't know how to find that, just go Google 10-year Treasury. Go to bankrate.com.
That's
you can
right.
see all the rates, and then you'll kind of know that's roughly where things might be. That's good. Do all banks track to that spread? Or seems like everyone uses a little bit different
Everybody's got a different
product
metric.
And a metric, right?
Everyone's got a different metric out there. The biggest indicator and factor in an interest rate is going to be the term of the loan.
Yeah.
My money is a lot cheaper on a 5-year loan versus a 10, and a 10-year versus a 15.
No question.
So as you extend that term a little bit and get that more manageable payment, you're going to expect to pay a little bit of a higher price for that.
Yeah. Well, but let's talk a little bit about the other ways that lending has changed recently. I know Bank of America had a little bit longer term loans as of recently, and maybe they've tightened that up a little bit. I as recent as maybe a year ago, I saw 20-year amortization schedules being offered. Occasionally, I would see slightly higher, depending on the whether it was real estate or
sure.
whether it was practice financing. I saw some practice financing stuff at 25 years at one point, I think, over the last 3 years.
Sure.
What causes a bank to start to get more conservative, you know, with that and maybe pull back?
I'll tell you, the regulatory environment that we've experienced for the last 3 years certainly did tighten up the bank, you know, pretty, I mean, things got real tight there for a minute. But I think we're back to where we feel comfortable with the regulatory environment. We understand what the OCC and the regulators are looking for us.
Yeah.
And you're going to see terms extend a little bit. We do have a 20-year real estate loan. Real estate is always going to be on a longer term.
Yeah.
Yep. The practice financing loans that we're doing, I would say 85% of what we finance is on a 10-year term, which is pretty standard in the industry. We do have a 15-year product. We dialed back a little bit, I think, in the last 2 years on the 15-year, but that's actually something we're starting up again.
Uh-huh.
And especially for a first-time practice owner, you know, the with the amount of student loan debt that's out there.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, if I get out of Tufts, I might be $650
that's right.
in student loans, and then I've got to go do my build out at $150 a foot if I'm in, you know, some downtown area. I got to block off the streets. I got to get some crazy permits. And
that's right.
I mean, I could be
grease somebody in Manhattan.
Yeah. Got to go break some fingers to like get a permit through the city.
That's right.
I mean, it's cutthroat here to get construction done.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like if I throw everything on a 10-year loan, I could be cramping my cash flow to the point where it freaks me out. I can't invest in marketing. I'm scared to pay $2 an hour more to an assistant.
That's right.
You know, and I hire the less capable people. I mean, it helps to have a little bit of that credit flexibility.
You want that cushion. And the biggest factor, you know, I was with a group of students yesterday, and the question always comes up, what's your rate? What's your rate? What's your rate? And I tell everybody the same thing. Interest rates should certainly be a factor in your loan decision, but it shouldn't be the number one and only factor. You want to have the most manageable payment with prepayment flexibility.
Yeah.
That's a good loan.
Yeah, term,
that's
right?
That's exactly right.
I mean, it's just hard to see. I find that happens all the time where I get out of school, I'll get the student loan. So the first thing I think about is if I knock that student loan out, right? And if I get rid of it, then sure. I'll be finally free of this burdensome payment.
That's right.
And to knock out $500,000 of student loan debt, you're looking at a solid like 7 to 9 years of good income. You're going to wait 7 to 9 years before you take any free cash flow and invest in growth.
You know,
and that's not reasonable. I just think people need to use debt as a tool rather than looking at it as like an adversary. I mean, there's no public company, Bank of America generally, or any public company, they're not going to go debt-free.
That's right.
It's hard to grow.
We borrow as much as anybody else.
Yeah, it's really difficult to grow and to have liquidity and be safe and make good business decisions when you're not using credit wisely.
It's probably one of the biggest mistakes that I see young associates make is that they focus so much on paying down the student loan debt and paying down other things. They haven't saved for that rainy day fund.
Yeah, there's no liquidity.
That's exactly
or they right. go to borrow a lot. They go to borrow and they've taken a student loan down from 600 to 400 or 400 to 300
mm-hmm.
and they have zero cash.
That's right.
And they go to get a loan.
That's right.
And they tell you, I went from 500 to 300 on my student loan. You're like,
and it's gone.
I don't.
Congratulations.
Care. Like, you
right.
have no cash.
It's not that I don't care. Well, it's that it doesn't really help me at all.
Yeah, it doesn't help you in underwriting, right?
That's right.
So that's what I mean from a perspective of like a borrower. You know, I think it feels like you're making progress when you take your loan down and then you feel like you've got a lower payment, maybe
right.
refinance it. But liquidity really is important in those early years.
It's 100% the thing that we look into most, especially from someone who's been out for 3 to 5 years. Because, yeah, you could pay down your student loan debt from 400 to 200 or 400 to 100. But at the end of the day, if you have a tough July and you don't have that financial backbone behind you, you don't have 20 or 30 grand saved in the bank, you know, you're going to have to borrow to get through that tough moment. That's what we're looking for.
We're looking for someone
to be able to get through that bump in the road because you're going to have one.
Yeah.
It's not all rainbows and unicorns at practice finance.
No, only in Silicon Valley.
That's right.
That's kidding. All right. So tell me a little bit about, I mean, and I want to just reemphasize, I don't think either one of us are saying stretch your loans out as far as you can possibly go and never pay them off.
That's right.
Just saying in the early years, if you've got a 15-year loan or a 10-year loan instead of a 7 or, you know, whatever, and that rate's a teeny bit higher. Maybe you're at 5.2 or 5.4 instead of 5.
That's right.
Or you're at 5 instead of 4.5.
Yep.
I mean, that slightly higher interest rate allows you to have more cash today to do things that are just smart.
That's right.
You know? Putting in the right investments into your practice.
That's right. And as a small business owner, cash flow is king.
Yeah.
And if you were opening up a pizza shop or opening up a dental office, you want the same thing, and you want to have excess cash flow at the end of the day to invest back into your business,
yeah,
to invest into yourself and your family.
Yeah.
So having those smaller payments are good. And I would add, with that flexibility of being able to pay it off when you do have that extra money laying around. So
yeah,
when you are financially stable and you took a 15-year loan, if in year 10 or 11 or 12 you can pay that off, that's great.
Yeah.
We appreciate getting paid early.
Totally.
We want to be paid on time, and we want to paid off at some point.
Yeah, I think that's probably the thing that we should emphasize, is that putting a loan on a particular amortization schedule does not mean that's the term in which you'll pay it off. It's just that's the minimum amount required.
That's exactly right.
And it's important to just have the mandatory debt payments that you have at a low rate. We like to look at a low percentage of income, you know, typically across personal, because most of these practices and new buyers, even seasoned buyers, they might want to do a remodel on their house.
Sure.
Or buy a home or relocate or increase the size of their home because their family's growing.
Buy their Mercedes.
Yeah, of course. That was the one thing I wanted to add. Have a third car.
That's right. Everybody needs a third car.
So, you know, at some point, it's good to be able to have that flexibility in your debt-to-income ratio to where you're able to save money still and put money away even as your debt payments increase on the personal side, because they
right.
will, most
yep.
likely.
100%.
Talk to me a little bit about prepayment penalties and how people view those, and how, you know, how should I think about that? I mean, a lot of people are like totally anti, should never have a prepayment penalty, and they don't really understand
yep.
that sometimes prepayment penalties
means different
on
things.
A loan means different things.
That's
and
right.
It's not. I mean, so let's explain to people what a prepayment penalty is and
sure.
how it works, and then why it's a bad idea or a good idea depending
yep.
on the situation.
That's great. So to make yourself dangerous when you're talking to your lender. When you talk about prepayment penalty, there's really two questions that you have to ask. A prepayment penalty, as standard in finance, is if you're paying us off in full during a certain time frame, usually it's years 0 through 5 of a loan, you're going to pay some type of a penalty for paying off early. The second question that you have to ask, though, is, okay, so if I have this prepayment penalty years 1, 2, 3, and 4, whatever that penalty might be, am I allowed to at least pay extra payments towards a principal balance during that time without a penalty? So I'm not looking to pay it off in full. I might just be looking to use some excess cash flow to help pay down that debt a little bit sooner. You know, when banks lend, we're looking to obviously make some money on that loan.
Yeah.
And if a loan pays off, typically within the first 2 or 3 years, that's a loss for us.
Yeah.
So you're going to see a couple things when there's a penalty involved. You should see some form of a step down. So as the loan matures, you would expect to pay less of a penalty to pay off in full in year 3 versus year 1 or year 5 versus year 2. That's standard in the industry. And then I would also say that having that flexibility to add extra payments towards principal, you'd want to have that. Some
yeah.
banks do offer that, some banks don't. You want to make sure you're asking that question up front and getting that in writing.
Yeah. So we can just clarify the difference between principal reduction,
mm-hmm.
right, and prepayment.
Correct.
Prepayment is when you pay off the whole loan or
That's
refinance
right.
it with another institution.
That's right.
If you've got a market rate and you've got a good loan that is fitting the terms of your the need that you have for term, the length of the loan,
yep.
then sometimes a prepayment penalty just gives the bank enough comfort to where they can charge a lower rate.
That's right. And that's what you'll typically see. So when you see a more stringent prepayment and full penalty, you're typically getting a very, very good deal on your interest rate at that point.
Yeah.
So you want to keep that as a factor. And if we're in an environment right now where rates are so low, we don't expect you to refinance out in 5 years from now, because rates will most likely be higher than they are today.
Yeah.
So that risk really isn't there. If rates are lower 5 years from now, something really major happened in the economy.
That we weren't expecting, yeah.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, I think sometimes people will look for a loan, or they'll be given advice to pursue a loan that has no prepayment penalty, when sometimes having a moderate or a reasonable declining prepayment penalty over the first 3 years to 5 years can make the rate lower.
That's
and
right.
Effectively, you'll just have lower interest being calculated on your loan balance. And
that's
if you're not
right.
planning on doing anything dramatic in 3 to 5 years anyway, why not have it there if it helps the bank be able to bring the rate down?
That's exactly right.
I mean, some banks might be, maybe some banks with a prepayment are not as competitive as a bank without a prepayment.
Sure.
And that doesn't mean you should go with a prepayment. I mean, look at the rate and compare terms, though.
Right. You want to look at the whole package.
Yeah, look at the whole package. I feel like people compare rates a lot, but they don't compare the rate and term to the identical rate and term. They
That's
compare
right.
a 5-year interest rate to a 10-year fixed interest rate. And
That's
say
right. I could offer you two loans right now. One's at 2%, one's at 10. I
yeah.
can tell you the 10% loan's probably going to have better terms.
Yeah. And so I think that seems to be a factor that I don't think people... I get that a lot. We get emails and we get loans coming in and people saying, well, this one's cheaper than this one. I'm going to go with the lower rate.
That's right. Interest rates are something that I think everybody understands. So that's where their comfort level lies. And that's why they ask those questions.
Yeah.
But when you're really, when you're truly looking to invest in yourself and invest in a practice, you really have to make yourself dangerous. Have a consultation with a lender, talk to multiple lenders, talk to your advisors that you're working with,
yeah.
and make sure you're asking deeper questions than just the rate, because
yeah.
the rate's an easy answer.
It's
everything else that comes along with it that can get you in the weeds.
Reading those amortization schedules can be tricky.
It's really fun.
I just got
it's a really
done,
good time.
Yeah. I just got done looking through a loan prepayment, some loan prepayment language that it was tied to an index, a very arbitrary index that
yeah.
they had created.
That's right.
It's like there was
banks love crazy algorithms that no one else understands
yeah.
except for the bank.
It was this like hyper local product, okay, that was probably underwritten on a bank's balance sheet one of their own assets.
Yep.
And I was reading through it, and they had created this index that they were tying somehow to LIBOR minus prime with some kind of inversion.
Yep.
If rates went down, there was a premium.
Yep.
If rates were higher in the point in time than when it was first underwritten, there was still a prepayment, but it was different.
Yeah, the
wild.
The penalties out there can be a little crazy. So again, you have to get out of the weeds and really ask some direct questions. We just had a client that tried to refinance out of a competitive bank, and their prepayment penalty was $100,000 or more.
I've seen that. That's the case in this one. It was a $1.7 million loan.
That's right.
And the prepayment, I think, was like $117,000.
Yeah, it's insane.
And they'd been in the product for like 8 years.
That's right.
I'm just like, holy cow. And
that's
then
someone who got
it,
a really good interest rate, though. So imagine that client. That client was really happy with that interest rate when they first got that loan. They thought
yeah.
it was the best deal they ever got.
Yeah, it's like, well, we'll give you a 1% interest rate as long as there's these arbitrary fees and this random prepayment that never expires.
I mean, I'm going to get paid one way or another.
I know.
It's not just through the interest rate. We'll figure some way out.
And you will find a bat. It's like Rocky in the shipyard in Rocky 1. You're going to go find that guy and break his fingers and get your money. Just kidding. Okay,
no, we're not as aggressive
okay.
we used to be.
That was 1982.
Easily.
All right.
Easily.
Okay. So let's talk about a little bit broader picture, because I want to draw on your experience outside of just lending.
Sure.
And kind of say, what do you think some of the biggest mistakes young dentists make? Then we can kind of move along. Let's not talk just like super young, but you know, what are some of the mistakes that dentists make in their career early on that you feel like that causes them trouble?
Sure. I think one mistake that we see, and not a lot, but enough that it's popped up, is they're not working enough in the beginning and working on their hand speed and getting their production up.
Okay.
I can't tell you how many times I've had an associate come up and want to buy $1 million practice, but they're only producing $300,000 or $400,000 in dentistry themselves.
At their current location.
That's exactly
as an associate.
Right. I would suggest that associates that go out there and work in multiple places, work for a corporate dental client, work in a private practice, work in something that was cosmetic, work in an insurance-driven practice, and see where your skill set fills, where you like to be, and then make your decisions based off of that. So certainly work hard in the beginning. You're never gonna, It never gets easier.
Yeah.
As you get older, you get more tired. I mean, I certainly work at a different pace today than I did 15, 20 years ago.
You only golf 18 holes a day now.
I'm not Jay Bear.
36.
I'm not Jay Bear.
Shout out to Jay. So, yeah, early on in your career, get the experience and know what your limits are. Know how you like to, how you want to have your day and week feel.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So, you guys, when you see someone who's not able to produce at a high level, they're not going to, you're not going to have a comfort level approving them to necessarily buy a practice that's outside of their comfort level, right?
You know, it's not just numbers. You know, you do have to match production capabilities. You have to make sure that that dentist is a good fit for that practice.
Yeah.
Because they're going to have to go in there, and day one, when they own, they're going to have to go in there and fulfill those patients' needs. And if those needs are certainly above and beyond what they're used to doing, that's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. Talk to me about another mistake or another challenge you think that dentists have faced throughout their careers, their entire careers. And what are things that you feel like if you could let people know, hey, avoid this. I've seen this mistake happen. I think it's a big deal. What are the kind of things that come across your mind?
Wait for the big house. Wait for the Mercedes. Wait for those things. I think that...
So like when you're 31 or 30, like wait till you're 30.
That's right. At least 30. At least 30.
So I totally 26. Agree with that, though. 26. I totally agree with that. And I'm a huge advocate of like deferred gratification on lifestyle until you have properly invested in yourself, your own experience, your own education, practice. Make sure your income's, you know, we try to measure what we call savings rate. And people need to have we like to see people be able to have a lot of free cash flow before they make the decision to increase the house.
And it really is something that you have to consider. So an example that I give to students today is if you're living a lifestyle that requires you to make $200,000, $300,000 per year.
To break even.
To pay your bills and to continue to live the lifestyle that you're living, you're taking yourself out of a lot of practice opportunities. You can't afford to buy a $600,000 producing practice because your lifestyle requires something greater.
Yeah.
So you're really, and let's be honest, the million-dollar practices that are out there, you know, they're not plentiful.
No.
You know, those opportunities that arise,
they don't come that often.
That's right.
Yeah.
In the $500,000 to $800,000 practice location, there's a heck of a lot more of those than there are those million-dollar producers.
Yeah.
So live lean in the beginning to make sure that you're able to get into opportunities easier, you're easily financeable, and you're not pigeonholing yourself into a space that you might not find that great opportunity down the road.
Totally. Kind of just to piggyback on that, because it's such a, I love that concept. And what we look at too, in some of the research that we do, when you pay on a mortgage, you know, or you pay for lifestyle expenses, those are things that are all after tax. So if you spend 10 grand a month, or let's say you spend 10 grand a month, you need to earn like 15,000 a month so that you have 10 grand a month.
If you live in New York City, 20,000 a month.
Yeah, 20,000 a month to like survive in New York. You got to make 30 to have 20,
right?
And so if you want to have any money to invest in growing your practice, and if you want to have any potentially bringing on an associate, marketing a little more efficiently, improving your space, like more operatories, a little bit larger square footage, if you want to open a second location to continue to be entrepreneurial and grow, like you when you have your lifestyle fixed costs go up, and it starts with housing, like you said, on the big house, everything becomes harder to do throughout your entire career. And it only takes 6 weeks after you move in before you're just at the same level of satisfaction as you were living in that 500 square foot flat with your girlfriend.
That's exactly right.
I mean, it doesn't change your satisfaction level with life that in a meaningful way.
Yep. Agreed.
Tell me about if there's anything else that comes to mind about mistakes or things that you see. We talked about housing, you know, and lifestyle. We talked about learning how to get your hands beat up and continue to produce more. Is there anything else that kind of pops into mind?
I would tell you, know your geography and know where you want to be in life. We have a lot of young doctors that come to us and say, well, I really want to be in Massachusetts. Okay, where in Massachusetts? You know, where do you want to live? Pick a place where you're going to be comfortable practicing, you're going to be comfortable living, and definitely have a conversation with your partner before you make those decisions.
Have you seen that go awry sometimes?
Oh, absolutely.
So what experiences made you have that? Well, give me an example when that popped into your mind. Did that pop in your mind from a person or from an experience that you saw, or just generally?
Yeah, so we had a client come with us, and he was hell-bent on moving to Maine. Just really wanted to be that Maine practicer, dental practice, and he was all about it. And he was talking with a doctor. We had a deal going on. It was $1 million practice, and he was a great buyer. From a financial standpoint, he did everything right.
Checked all the boxes.
Checked every single box. Very, one of the easiest, probably, approvals we ever had. But when it got down to it, he gets to the closing table probably a week before closing, and his wife says, I'm not moving to Falmouth, Maine. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
I thought we would live in southern New Hampshire, or we would live in Portsmouth, or we would live in Newburyport. You're 3 hours from that location. I'm not moving to the middle. That's basically Canada.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, that's you wouldn't think that stuff happens, but it really does.
I think you're
so fixated on trying to meet that goal that you're not having those conversations with everyone around you. So make sure that you're really thinking through everything when it comes to that. It's not just about being in a practice that does $1 million. That's, yeah, you hear that a lot from associates.
Looking for $1 million practice.
That's right. Look for a practice that you want to live, work, and reside in.
Yeah.
And your family and friends are supportive of that as well.
I think that's really good advice. Tell me a little bit about space and size of a practice. Like, what mistakes do you see people make as it relates to either having, I mean, too big, too small,
sure,
you know, everything in between? Talk about your thoughts on what kind of size of practice should I have.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is different from location to location. A practice in Manhattan is going to look and operate very differently from a practice in Nebraska, or a practice in South Florida is going to look very different from a practice in Texas. The best advice I try to give is to make sure that where you spend your money is on income-producing areas of your location. You know, get that fifth operatory opposed to having the bigger waiting room. Make sure that the places that you're spending your money are places that will produce you income when you're building that space.
Yeah.
You want to make sure it's efficient. You want to make sure it flows very well. You want to make sure that you've had discussions with your architectural firm. You've talked with Schein or Patterson and your equipment specialist. You know, so you want to make sure that space is efficient and is financially effective, and you're not wasting space and wasting money on areas that aren't going to produce you any income. The second thing I would say is rent. You know, you want to make sure rent is something that never goes away. It is a fixed cost, and you want to make sure that the rent is manageable.
Yeah.
Certainly, that's different in New York City versus Southern California, but you want to make sure you're getting yourself in a situation where, you know, $15,000, $20,000 a month rent in an area that doesn't produce that type of dentistry, you know, you want to make sure that you're making good decisions there.
Man, a lot of stuff to talk about there. Let's just back up real quick on the on this efficiency concept. I'm going through this right now. It's about killing me, trying to figure out personally, like, we live in an old house, and I'm trying to figure out, do I tear it down and start over? Do I remodel it?
Sure.
How big should it be? How do I want the master on the main level? So, or upstairs, like, what's most efficient? I'm kind of OCD, so for me, I've spent a lot of time designing. This is my second architect I've talked to, right? Trying to figure out, how do I minimize the space but maximize the efficiency,
sure,
like the usable areas, right? And think about, like, what is going to be, because I'm going to be paying on this thing forever,
right? Spending your time.
I'm going to sink millions of dollars into this thing, or, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. Where I live, my dirt's really expensive. So
sure,
even though my dirt's more worth way more than my house, it's that way in Manhattan. It's that way in
absolutely
a lot of metro areas. And so you have to live with this choice that you made that's probably your most consequential choice. Cost itself, the efficiency, is going to be the biggest determiner of how effective your practice really is.
That's right.
And the house that you live in is also going to be the biggest cost drag in your life.
That's
It's going to determine the amount of furnishings and the vehicles and the way you live. And those two decisions, I feel like people make them really quickly.
Yep.
Sometimes they don't really take the proper amount of time to think and plan. And I know that as I've done that, it's made me be able to still have a really great floor plan, but have a lot less cost associated with it, because I've cut space that I didn't need and added space in places I did need.
Sure.
And I think that there's a lot of truth in how that correlates to the dental practice,
yep,
you know, and vice versa. And I just think it, I don't know, I'd let you speak to that a little bit, because I think that's kind of, it's a key area.
Yeah, you know, we certainly see, a ton of different floor plans for dental practices, and you can tell when someone has spent the time and the effort into really putting together an efficient floor plan that's going to maximize space, maximize cost, and really put their time and work in. You know, I say it all the time, like the Shines and Patterson and Benko's of the world, they do a really good job. This is what they do. So yeah. if you're walking through a space and you're not attached to the hip with your equipment specialist, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
You know, I can't tell you how many times we've met with doctors who are about to sign a lease, but never had a rough design plan done.
Like you seems
have a,
like that should be 6 months out, right?
Yes,
or it should be a long time out. You know, thinking
right.
about. Because, I mean, I see 1,000 to 1,500 square feet sometimes in excess space that's just floating unnecessarily.
That's right?
Right. I mean, you'll see waiting rooms that are unnecessarily bloated. You'll see, you know, children's play areas that are 800 square feet. You know what I mean?
The waterfall.
Waterfall.
What the heck do you need a waterfall for?
Yeah, I mean, there's just a lot. I mean, I don't know. Like,
I saw a practice with a waterfall that didn't have more than two operatories. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, ultimately, get me back into a chair
as fast as I can.
If I show up, like, get me back into a chair and get going.
That's right.
And if you have very little waiting room space, in my opinion, I mean, enough to be comfortable. But more operatories so that you can make me not have to sit out there and feel, even if I have to wait for a while to get treatment, I just want to feel like I'm getting in and getting out, and that you have the capacity to see me. And
that's right.
I don't know. I'm just, from a patient's perspective, I feel like sometimes space planning, you know, the space for front office, the space for the doctor's private office, the space for waiting, and the space for
the
children.
Private office with the full bath and the shower.
Yeah,
like that's not making you any money.
Shower at home. You have a house that you just got a huge mortgage for.
Shower at home.
I just think that there's just a lot of planning that needs to go in, and financing is such an important part of that. So,
sure.
Anyway, talk to me about, before we let you go, man. You've given us a ton of great advice. Talk to me about some kind of takeaways you'd like people to have when it comes to lending and things you've seen. Just any final takeaways of that, just good advice and kind of recommendations you might have before parting.
Sure. No, I appreciate that. The best advice I can give certainly new associates is start building your team today. You know, get a good accountant, get a good attorney, start having discussions with lenders early on.
Yeah.
Make sure you've got a good financial advising firm behind you. And just start making good decisions.
Yeah.
So that team is going to be really, really important as you move into practice ownership. And as far as lending goes, you know, when there's that saying, when banks compete, you win. That's absolutely true. But you want to make sure you're working with a partner, and your bank is truly a partner in this decision that understands what you're trying to accomplish. If you sit in front of a banker and they're not getting it, and they're not trying to solve for what you are trying to accomplish in this transaction, get up and walk away as fast as possible, because that's going to be a bad decision.
Well, that's great, man. I think there's a lot of value in working with a specialty lender, someone who knows the space. I mean, we've spent most of this time talking about non-lending related issues, building a team, a good strategy, and you can just see how a specialist like yourself, who's been in the industry for that long, is able to build a lot of opinions that are value adds to the transaction.
That's right.
You know, and it really helps to have to surround yourself with people who you can trust and have a good team that helps bring you some accountability to maybe the decisions that you'd make otherwise. So thanks for all your insight, Bill. Really appreciate it. And I feel like we could have this interview once a year and you'd be able to offer a lot of great value. So we'll look forward to having you on again. And thank you for your time.
No, thank you. It was a pleasure.